But my favorite story of students doing that, you see, is a student, apparently, who approached Hegel with a passage that Hegel had written and said, Professor Hegel, I don't understand what this passage means in this book that you have written. I think it was on time and being, or Sein und Dasein, or whatever it was. And he Hegel took the book and he read the paragraph. Finally, he gave it back to the student and he said, when I wrote that paragraph, there were two who understood it. God and I. Now there is only one. Oh, yes. Well, that's got nothing to do with anything either, but it's funny. Now then, I began by saying that that there were certain broad areas that are touched by this broad topic of the use of the Old Testament and the New. First, text critical issues, and then second, the larger issue of the nature of law, patterns of continuity and discontinuity in this regard. Number three, there is quite clearly a whole array of issues that fall under the sort of rubric of how the New Testament is actually interpreting the Old in explicit contexts. Now, there are many questions under that rubric. But when the New Testament comes along and says, out of Egypt have I called my son, is in fact fulfilled in Jesus coming out of Egypt, when on the face of it, Hosea doesn't seem to be going down that line, what on earth is going on? Now, in fact, in the New Testament, the two books that are most difficult in this regard are, in my judgment, Matthew and Hebrews. They are full of quotations, and they seem, on many occasions, to be using the Old Testament text in a way where, if you used a text that way in an exegesis paper, you would fail. You see? So the question is, what is going on? What is the warrant for this sort of thing? When I was writing my Matthew commentary 20 years or so ago, I read, of course, many, many, many other commentaries first. And one of the most interesting in this regard was one by John Broaddus. It was published in 1886. John Broaddus was a Southern Baptist, and he was a very, very good scholar, very well trained and theologically alert, and had read very widely. And he wrote this long commentary on Matthew. But what was, although much of it was brilliant, much of it was very, very competent indeed, what was so interesting in it was that every time he got to one of these difficult passages in Matthew, where Matthew quotes the Old Testament, John Broaddus would end up saying something like this, not in exactly these words, but with this intent. I don't have a clue what Matthew's doing here. I'm sure God understands it, but I don't. And he keeps running going. I mean, no, he doesn't put it quite that bluntly, but that's basically what he's saying. I don't have a clue what Matthew's doing. Now, in one sense, that's not an entirely bad approach. I mean, it's acknowledging your ignorance. It's rather different from the approach of my own Doktorvater. My Doktorvater was Barnabas Linders. And his first significant book was called New Testament Apologetic. And in that book, his thesis was that the New Testament writers basically quote the Old by ripping texts out of their context, abusing them gloriously, repeatedly, and perversely in order to justify their Christian presuppositions. That's And the thesis in a nutshell, New Testament apologetic, you see? So in that sense, you see, Barnabas Linders thinks that he does understand what's going on. And he thinks that, in fact, the New Testament writers are really quite perverse. Whereas John Broaddus looks at what's going on, he doesn't understand what's going on, and he admits it. If I've got to choose between the two approaches, on the whole, I prefer John Broadus. But on the other hand, is there something a little more that we can say? That is to say, can we begin to try to understand what these New Testament writers are actually doing? What is going through their heads? What do they think they are doing? How are they reading the text to say the sorts of things they do? Not, of course, just when they quote a text and may simply be making verbal allusions, but especially when they deploy introductory formulae. They're the ones that are most interesting. This happened in order that it might be fulfilled what was said by the Spirit of God according to the prophet Isaiah, saying. You see, that doesn't give you a lot of wriggle room. If you simply have an allusion of some sort, or even if you have a quotation, you've got to be very careful what's being affirmed. Now, I was brought up in a Christian home. And my father had studied Greek and Hebrew, and kept them up, his Greek better than his Hebrew, all his life. He didn't begin to learn French until he was 26, but eventually he became part-time a translator for the federal government of Canada, and then became a church planter and was in pastoral ministry and so on. His French was superb. So he would read his Bible in French and read his Bible in English and memorized vast tracts. And he was somewhat taciturn. He was not extremely verbal. But when he wanted to talk to us, his children, very frequently he talked in Bible quotations. So, we would start complaining, whining about something. He would turn to us and he would say, "This is the day which the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." Now, you see, not for a moment was he saying that this was an exhaustive explanation of what that text meant in its context, you see. But on the other hand, his mind was so steeped in Scripture that he thought in those categories, you see? Or if one of us started rabbiting on, talking about things we don't know, you know when you're 14 or 15, you're prepared to pontificate on absolutely everything? So some matter would come up and one of us would vent an opinion with great dogmatism and certainty, and my father would turn and he would say, and this is King James English, you might not understand it, "He wist not what to say, so he said." Now, let me explain that one in case you didn't get that. It's from the Transfiguration narrative, of course. Wist is Old English. It's from the Greek oida. Wist, he did not know what to say, so he said. So it pictures a Peter on the Mount of Transfiguration when the three figures appear, and he did not know what to say, so he said. You see, and my father would simply stand there and, "He wist not what to say, so he said." Which sort of put us all in our place. But he was not saying that this was sort of the fulfillment of the Transfiguration narrative either, was he? You see? And there are some times when the New Testament writers quote the Old Testament and they're using Old Testament language without trying to say anything much more clever than that, too. So it's very important not to sort of make overclaims. But where you have fulfillment formulae or the like, you don't have any wriggle room at all. And then you've got to start figuring out exactly what is being claimed and how it works and so on. And in this respect, there are several approaches that people commonly make. Let me offer two or three of them. And these are not mutually exclusive. They overlap. They all have some strengths and some weaknesses. They work in some times. They don't work in other times. There are problems with them. But let me just mention some of these categories. Some of you, of course, will already be thoroughly familiar with these, but they might be new to some, so I mention them. First, there is the approach of what is called historically sensus plenior, of course, which was often the category deployed by Catholics, the fuller sense. And in the case of at least some Catholic theologians, the sensus plenior was, in some ways, within the magisterial jurisdiction of the church. So there is a kind of deposit of faith given to the church, and the magisterium has the right, indeed the responsibility, of unpacking what texts say. So yes, it's true that in the New Testament, Peter is not called the Pope, but nevertheless out of Matthew 16 and other texts, then there is a sensus plenior that eventually is unpacked by the church, which authorizes ultimately in 1870 even the doctrine of the infallibility of the Pope. Do you see? So this is really based on a notion of a deposit of faith, a deposit of truth that has been given to the church, which allows the church then not to, in the church's view, add to Scripture. That's not what the church thinks it's doing. Not to contradict church Scripture. That's not what the church thinks it's doing. Protestants think that's what it's doing, but that's not what the church thinks it's doing. But rather to unpack in a fuller sense what is already there. And that same sort of approach then is used by some Catholic scholars when they read the New Testament use of the Old Testament as well. They say that's what's going on. There's a fuller sense from the Old Testament that's being unpacked in the New, you see? And some Protestants use the same sort of category. Vern Poitras uses that on some occasions. Now, I have some problems with that. That are both historical and definitional. There's a sense of sensus plenior that I don't object to. That is, provided it can be warranted textually. But if it becomes an abstract category that justifies almost anything, then it's almost impossible to falsify. And despite the protestations that this is unpacking a greater sense, at the end of the day, it strikes the outsider as merely arbitrary. And at the end of the day, it becomes less and less credible the harder and harder you push it. You see, which is part, of course, of the criticism of the Reformation as well. Then there is an approach that is taken by Gottlieb Frege, picked up by John Feinberg and others. This makes a distinction between sense and referent. Now, this is not the distinction of Hirsch, who makes the distinction between sense and significance. That's another one. This is the distinction between sense and referent. Begin with a category like President of France. Now, anybody who's literate in Europe knows what that expression means. It's an abstract category. But in addition to the sense, that is the meaning of the expression, one may ask what the referent is. That is, which president of France? Are you talking about Jacques Chirac? Or are you talking about some previous president of France, or maybe a president of France under the Third Republic rather than the Fifth, or whatever? You see, there is a distinction to be made between the sense of the expression and the particular referent. So, the mayor of Chicago is a sense category, but Richard M. Daley is the referent, at least at the moment. Do you see? And we can multiply examples. So, a category like Antichrist may, in fact, be a sense category. And then you may ask, yeah, well, since 1 John speaks of many antichrists, then there might be referent categories that you've got to unpack as well, you see. So in this respect, then, people have argued that many, many Old Testament texts speak at the level of sense, but the unpacking of the referent comes later. And in fact, some would argue that some of these sense passages have many reference. So that in some ways, you see, there is an entering into rest when the people go into the promised land. There's an entering into rest when people return from the exile. Psalm 95 speaks to the people who are in the land of an entering into rest, even though they're already in the land, so the land can't be all of it. So entering into rest is the general sense category, but where the particular referent is, what particular entering into rest, well, that's a bit different. I mean, finally, in the apocalypse, there's an entering into rest that has to do with the dawning of the new heaven and the new earth. And Jesus, for his part, says, come unto me, all you who labor, and I will give you rest, you see? So there may be multiple entering into rests that are part of a streamlined package that unpack the sense in terms of the referent. But obviously, that's useful. But it certainly does not explain many things. Because, after all, in some instances, Old Testament texts and other texts, but Old Testament texts give us not only the sense, but the referent. Yet when you come to the New Testament, there is a different referent. So the question becomes, what's the warrant for the shift? The question is always, what's the warrant? Another approach that is increasingly common is what's often called canon criticism or canonical theology. Now, in fact, there are different forms of canon criticism, two dominant ones. There's the kind worked out by Sanders, John Sanders, and then there's the kind that's worked out by Brevard Childs. Now, the Sanders one I won't go into here. It's too far removed from our concerns at the moment. It's interesting, but I don't have time to unpack it. Brevard Childs is another kettle of fish. He does not actually himself use the expression canon criticism. That's an expression that everybody uses of him and sees him as the father of canon criticism, but he himself does not actually use the term. Nevertheless, it's a useful summary of what he does. And there are a lot of people who are related to Childs or have been influenced by him or studied under him and so forth. Now, I need to relate Childs, I think, to the larger Yale school. Childs does a great deal of work with a text that is profoundly admirable, very interesting, very challenging, very useful. On the other hand, in my view, there is a problem at the heart of it that is tied to the whole Yale school that we need to think about. So let me say something about the Yale school. By the Yale school, I don't mean absolutely everybody who teaches at Yale at the moment, but nevertheless, there's a certain kind of stream of tradition that's bound up with Hans Fly, The Eclipse of Biblical Narrative, and George Lindbeck and many of his writings, and less so Brevard Childs, although he's been influenced by his colleagues at Yale as well. So let me try to unpack trace of scholarship. Hans Frey's book, The Eclipse of Biblical Narrative, wielded an enormous amount of interest. His argument, in brief, is this. Now, Frey himself is dead, of course, now. His argument is this, that until the rise of the Enlightenment, people read the stories in the Bible just as they lie there. They knew how to read the accounts as stories. They knew how to read them as narratives. They read them realistically, and it shaped their living and their thinking and so forth. But with the rise of historical criticism, people started trying to find out what was behind the text. And those in the more liberal tradition didn't believe quite what the narrative said, so they're trying to explain what really lay behind it. What produced the narrative like this? What kind of community produced this? What kind of source criticism produced this? What kind of whatever, you see? So it's always trying to find something behind the text, and people are no longer intelligently reading the text. And then, he says, the conservatives come along, and in order to reply to the liberals, they do the same thing. They're no longer just reading the text as text either. They're saying, well, you say that what really happened was this, but we say that what really happened was this. And that might be a sort of more conservative line, but at the end of the day, they stop reading the text as text, and they're reading behind the text all the time. So people are playing games behind the text, and what they're losing is the text itself. And so what he speaks of, therefore, is the eclipse of biblical narrative. The biblical narrative somehow is lost in all of this as you start playing a whole lot of historical critical games behind the text. Now, in some ways, that's quite insightful. It is also, in my judgment, profoundly misleading. Because in this pre-Enlightenment period, when the people were reading the narrative, they were not only reading the narrative as narrative, but they believed it to be true narrative. They weren't reading it as if it were 19th century fiction. They were reading it as narrative, that's true, but they believed it to be true narrative. So when the liberals were reading behind the text, they weren't saying, well, this is the narrative, and now we're interested in something farther back. They were reading it and discounting the narrative as true, and saying what really happened took place behind the text in various sources or various naturalistic phenomena or whatever. And when the conservatives replied, and they were trying to say, yes, but what really happened behind the text was such and such in order to say that what the text was saying was true. In other words, the conservatives and the liberals in this Enlightenment period were not playing quite the same game. And it is a bit deceptive on Fry's part to pretend that they were. Because if you keep saying that they were playing the same game behind the text, you see, then what you invite is what actually does happen in the Yale School. Namely, that people start reading the text, but are not interested in the text's extra-textual referentiality. Let me explain that. It is extraordinarily important. There is a sense in which George Lindbeck is the best exemplar of what I'm talking about. You read large swaths of Lindbeck, and he's getting people to read their Bible, to think imaginatively in terms of what the Bible says. We've got to go back to preaching the Bible. We've got to go back to talking about the Bible. The Bible must fire our imagination. We ought to be memorizing the Bible, having devotions from the Bible. You read all this stuff in Lindbeck, and you think, boy, oh boy, oh boy, the guy is not only conservative, he's almost a fundamentalist. Except if you read him closely, he is either disavowing or refusing to affirm the possibility of affirming the connection between what the text says and that to which the text refers, that is, the extra-textual referentiality. I have in mind someday, if I am perverse enough, and probably I am, to write an essay with a rather cheeky title, The Bibliolatry of George Lindbeck. Because, you see, if you take the most conservative right-wing fundamentalist, the most conservative right-wing fundamentalist still is not a bibliolater. Because the most conservative right-wing fundamentalist thinks that the Bible is talking about something outside the Bible, namely God. The fundamentalist is not inviting you to worship the Bible. It's still talking about something outside the Bible, namely God and what takes place in history, all being true. But George Lindbeck takes us back to the Bible and then refuses to say that the Bible goes beyond the Bible in extra-textual referentiality. Now, it's not that he is overtly denying that there's a God out there. Don't misunderstand me. I mean, George is not stupid. He's saying, however, that the only way we can think about this God is precisely by the categories that come to us in texts that fire our imaginations and the like, but refuses to say that then what this text is saying, whether the language be analogical or anything else, is true about the extra-textual referentiality. There's a hiatus there that comes from the postmodern presuppositions of the man. And it is desperately important to see that it is not the Bible that saves us. It's what the Bible is talking about that saves us, namely God and what he has done in redemptive history and the like. Do you see? If you only go back as far as the Bible, then there is a sense in which your terminus, your end, is, in fact, the Bible. But the Bible itself, however truly it speaks, and I do believe it does speak truly, is pointing outside the Bible. It's bearing witness to who God is and what he has done in redemptive history. And what saves us is the God who has entered space-time history to do certain things in redemptive history to bring about our salvation. Do you see? By the calling of Abraham, by the raising of Moses, by the giving of the law, and ultimately by the sending of his son and the incarnation and the death and the cross. You see? It's very important to see that it's that which saves us to which the Bible speaks, to which the Bible bears witness. So within this framework, then, it seems to me that the Yale School, precisely influenced by Hans Frey, who wants to speak of the narrative but refuses to say that the narrative speaks truly, and casts both confessional Christians and flat-out liberals in the same camp as dealing behind the text, is not facing the issue of whether or not the text is telling the truth about things. So that when you come to Lindbeck, then, you have this move toward the text that fires the imagination, but I can't find in him extratextual referentiality. In fact, this year, I put one of my graduate assistants, Trinity, bless its heart, pays for doctoral assistance and so on. And I put this student on going through the entire corpus of George Lindbeck from the very beginning. First all of his books, then all of his articles, then all of his reviews, scanning them for any discussion whatsoever of these matters, taking notes on them, photocopying the relevant materials. I got a stack this thick that I've now gone through. You know, I know what George Lindbeck says on these matters. And the fact of the matter is, you simply cannot find a place where he will affirm, and many places where, in fact, he denies, any possibility of talking intelligently about extratextual referentiality. In other words, the God becomes the text. That's bibliolatry. Now, someone like Brevard Childs does something a bit different. But it's part of this larger Yale school. There's a sense in which Childs disagrees profoundly with Lindbeck, partly because he is himself, first and foremost, an exegete, and an exegete in a fairly conservative tradition that wants to deal with real space-time events and real history and so on. But he has another interesting hiatus. There's a sense in which he wants to establish the links within the canon at the theological level. And along those lines, he has some enormously useful and helpful analyses, very important things to say. I think that his commentary on Exodus, for example, is a classic. There's a great deal to be learned from his commentary on Isaiah, although there are parts where I don't think he's right. His biblical theology of the Old and New Testament, just countless insights all the time. I read them, I profit from them, and so on. Yet at the same time, he wants to affirm in the same breath classic analyses of historical critical categories that in fact cannot, on the face of things, be easily integrated at the level of extratextual truth to the way he sees the storyline developing within the text within the text itself. There's a hiatus there, do you see? Now, I will come to that tomorrow when I deal a little bit more with the question of the New Testament's appeal to Old Testament sequence in its use of the Old Testament. We'll come to that one again. It's a very interesting set of arguments. Now, within that framework, in my view, Childs is eminently useful, but canon criticism as a whole raises some issues that we have to address, it seems to me. Still, the useful part of it is, in a sense, at least a little bit like what I was trying to do with John 1, 4, and 5 yesterday. Do you recall when I came to John 1, 4, and 5, I said that if you read verses 4 and 5 in the light of 1 to 3, first of all, you don't know the rest of the book, then you will be inclined to read those verses, it seems to me, a certain kind of way. And then, once you have read the rest of the book several times, you are inclined to read 4 and 5 the other way. And the question is, which way is right? And I would insist both. And the John layers things that way. He wants us to read it that way. It's one of the marks of John's depth as a writer, you see. And I think that he's doing this sort of thing, in fact, again and again and again in his book. And there is a sense in which canon criticism, rightly done, is doing a similar sort of thing, but not in the context of one book, but in the context of the entire canon. So you read certain events, certain texts, certain arguments one way, and then as more text is given, you go back and reread and reread, and you start seeing things through different eyes again. Now, I don't have any problem with that. If that's what you mean to by sensus plenior, I don't have any problem with that. I don't have any problem with canon criticism that runs along those lines. But, and it is a very big but, in the case of John's Gospel where that's been done, both ways are text warranted. In other words, you can see what John is doing. You can justify the double layer. You can understand what is going on. You must not let this appeal to canon criticism this appeal to canonical rereading, becomes so broad and so controlling that at the end of the day, you fail to see how anything is text warranted. It becomes a step of raw fideism. The question again, as always, is warrant, warrant, warrant. What is the warrant for reading it this way? And you do not want your warrant to become so abstract and airy-fairy that it's merely an appeal to the broader canon. If it ever becomes that, then sooner or later you're likely to take the next step, which is found not so much in Brevard Chiles, although it's found a bit there, but it's certainly found in Brevard Chiles students quite commonly. Namely, that the appeal to canon as your base for rereading is itself grounded in the church deciding what the canon is, so that the authority for it becomes the community which has reread and reread, and so today we also reread and reread and reread, and things become in principle open-ended. Do you see? And now you really are into a very postmodern mode, and the canon itself loses its function as the norming norm. You no longer see it as the revelatory word. God has spoken. You no longer see Tanakh as Jesus saw Tanakh. It no longer functions that way. The authority is finally in the community that rereads and rereads and rereads and rereads and rereads today. And it becomes as open-ended as postmodernism is. That is where a great deal of contemporary canon criticism finally ends up. Another approach to these matters that's worth thinking about. This approach is very helpful, but it has some limitations. A great many people who study the use of the Old Testament appeal to the Jewish midot. They are rules of appropriation. They are hermeneutical rules of appropriation. The rabbis developed these rules. And how many there are depends on the particular rabbinic period. So often 7 rules are cited. In other sources, 13 rules are appealed to. So you're probably familiar with some of these yourself. Probably the best known is this one, at the risk of trying to transliterate the Hebrew, Kal Vachomer. Literally, of course, that means the light and the heavy. Now, the light and the heavy is merely a rabbinic way of talking about what we mean in the Latin rhetoric tradition by an a fortiori argument. If this, how much more that? You see? So the light, if this, then how much more that? The heavy. That's one of the Jewish rules of appropriation of Scripture in later Scripture, and indeed in theological discourse. You find it all over the place. So any decent treatment of the rabbis discusses these various things and the various midot and who is said to have formulated them and so on. So, as a result, there are many textbooks today that go through, let's say, the Pauline corpus and try to understand how Paul is reading the text in terms of the various midot. And you can actually go through text after text after text and say, yes, I mean, Paul's argument here is appealing to this rule, or it's appealing to this rule, and so on. And that's all very helpful. So, Earl Ellis is doing this sort of thing all the time in his many books on this subject, and many others as well. It's an analysis of the appropriation techniques. Are you with me? But although that's useful, it has 2 problems with it that we need to understand. First, just because some Jewish rabbis use a particular technique in some places does not by itself prove that this is a legitimate understanding of a text. In other words, if all you're doing is engaging in discussion of methods so that you can see that similar methods are being deployed, by itself that does not constitute genuine warrant. It constitutes a kind of explanation. It does not constitute warrant. You still have to say, yeah, but is that right? Is this a genuine instance of the light and the heavy? Or is it a misuse? You see, just the appeal to the rule itself is merely descriptive stuff. By itself, it does not constitute warrant. But the more important problem with this approach, as useful as it is, as interesting as it is, the more important problem is it does not help you distinguish why Paul, the Christian with Jewish background, is reading the same texts as his unconverted Jewish friendly scholars and coming up with very different conclusions. It does not help you explain that difference. So they're both using the same appropriation techniques. Oh, jolly good. Very nice. Then why are they reading the text so differently? In other words, even after you've proved that there's a kind of kal vahomer argument here and not somewhere else, why, in the net aggregate of the use of all of these rules, does Paul come out seeing Christ in all kinds of Old Testament places where his fellow scholars, who are unconverted but equally informed as Jews, don't find Christ? In other words, this may be interesting, but it explains very little, because it does not deal with the distinguishing warrant of Christian exegesis. And at the end of the day, Paul is arguing in a book like Romans and Galatians, elsewhere, but certainly in those two, Paul is actually arguing that his reading of the Old Testament is not a reading, one useful reading amongst many. If you're a conservative Orthodox Jew, you may have that reading. Personally, I have this reading, and somebody else might have another reading. And the Gnostics will come along and have another reading. See, Paul, whatever he is not a postmodern. Paul is actually arguing that the positions that he himself once formally held as to what the Old Testament text says are wrong. And he now thinks he's got it right. And at that level, the Midot don't help us that much. In fact, the more you point out that the Midot are shared by Paul and his rabbinic colleagues, the more useless they are for explaining the distinguishing warrant. So although it's all very helpful study and so on, at the end of the day, it's supremely unexplaining. Does that make sense? Now, partly because of that, Douglas J. Moo, who wrote his dissertation on the use of the Old Testament in the Passion narratives and was published eventually by Sheffield University Press, he saw precisely the nature of this problem and developed a slightly different set of terminologies, which have been picked up here and there. They haven't been picked up as widely as they deserve. It's better. It doesn't answer everything, but it is making a contribution. He distinguishes between what he calls appropriation techniques, roughly the Midot, and hermeneutical axioms. He is saying, in effect, that although the synoptic writers, he does a bit on John, but he's primarily synoptics, in their Passion narrative, use the Old Testament texts in ways that appropriate the Old Testament analogous to the way the rabbis do so, nevertheless, they come up with very distinctive conclusions because in addition to the appropriation techniques, which he shares with the others, which they share with the others, they deploy hermeneutical axioms, which they do not share with the others. So that the distinguishing feature in the use is not in the Midot, in the appropriation techniques. The distinguishing feature is in the hermeneutical axioms. But then the hermeneutical axioms turn out to be things like Jesus really is the Messiah and things of that order. Now, there's no doubt that those do become hermeneutical axioms in New Testament exegesis. But, and again, it is a very big but, the question is, what is the warrant for those hermeneutical axioms? You're back to questions of warrant again. Because if you simply say, well, the real difference is that dear old Matthew does believe that Jesus is the Messiah and his Jewish friends don't, so they read the Testaments differently, then how far away are you from Barnabas Linders? Who is saying, in fact, the New Testament writers are ripping Old Testament texts out of their context precisely because they are already convinced that Jesus is the Messiah. Barnabas Linders is a bit more cynical the way he puts it. But in fact, how far are you away at the level of warrant from thinking about these things? We're stopping here just for a moment while we switch a tape, okay? I'm going to give you two more of these problem areas before we start putting something together again. Let me go on just a bit farther, and then I'll stop for questions. I want to make two more points, and we'll open it up for questions, okay? Okay? Now, the two further questions that I want to introduce very briefly, and then we'll unpack some of these things later. Many others refer to some form or other of typology. Now, there is typology and there is typology. There is not a universal definition of typology. And in some ways, typology has received a lot of very bad press because of the extremes and the stupidities of some people in appealing to it. Thus, for example, if Rahab the harlot puts down a red string or a red piece of cord from her window, well, clearly the red refers to the blood of Christ. You see, there is a kind of old-fashioned pietistic typology that is completely and utterly uncontrolled. It's very reverent, but it's uncontrolled. And it can be applied to all kinds of things. I mean, it's applied to numbers, and it's applied to all kinds of things. For example, I keep files on this stuff. I have such a perverse mind. Have you ever... Do you remember how many fish there are in John 21? No. 153. There are scores and scores of interpretations of that 153. I have files on them all. Did you know that 153 is the triangular number of 17? Now, for the non-mathematicians amongst us, a triangular number, it's called a triangular number because it works like this. And so on. So you start building, you see, an equilateral triangle. And when you finally got 153 dots, you will find 17 on each side. So 153 is the triangular number of 17. Isn't that interesting? Yes? And 17 equals 10 plus 7. 10 is the number of the Ten Commandments. 7 is not only the number of perfection, it is 3 plus 4. And 3 is the number of the Trinity, and 4 is the number of the church built four square. Thus, you see, the 153 fish represent Christ's mission to become fishers of men, in which the disciples are sent out in the name of the Holy Trinity to build the church four square in all of its perfections according to the law of God. Now, I bet... I bet that if I did it with a straight face, I could preach this in most of our churches and people would come out saying, deep, deep. But But you see, that's the problem with it. It's so uncontrolled. And yet, at the same time, sometimes numbers really are symbol-laden. But that's a genre-related matter as well, and apocalyptic numbers are regularly genre-related. Outside of apocalyptic, you've got to be far, far, far more careful about such matters. So this question of typology has many, many different phases to it, and it is very easy to make typology look really silly. On the other hand, there is enough to typology that it shouldn't be dismissed. There is one huge question connected with typology that I'll mention in a moment. But transparently, for example, there are countless uses of texts in the New Testament that appeal to Jesus as the great David. And not a few of the usages of the Psalms, for example, in the Passion narratives, not least Psalm 69, are bound up with the assumption of a Davidic typology. That is, what happens to some person or institution or structure in the past recurs in some sense. It recurs and it may be augmented. So that what is deeply significant in David's life must, because there is a promise to David that there will be a Davidic line that continues, it must in some sense be repeated in great David's greater son. That's the assumption. So if David thus faces the horrible experience of being betrayed by his friend, so also will great David's son be experiencing these sorts of things. Do you see? There is a typology that operates, and it is assumed again and again and again. But how you define such typologies, how you warrant them, that's a more interesting and difficult issue. The most disputed area in this regard, and it is not a conservative-liberal dispute or anything like that. It is disputed by people with an equally high view of Scripture, for example. The most disputed area in the unpacking of what typology consists in is whether or not typology is warrantably future-looking. Warrantably anticipatory, warrantably predictive, or is typology in the nature of the case seen only after the fact? Now that's a huge question, and it is very difficult. I will come back to that toward the end of tomorrow if I have time. You'll see it on the bottom of the outline. It's a very interesting question, and not at all easy. But I will come back to that one. Then, the last issue that must be faced rather briefly. When we start thinking of the use of the Old Testament in the New, it is worth distinguishing quotation, allusion, echo, and even thematics. Now, I, again, don't have time to unpack all of those categories in detail. A very helpful work has been done in this area by Richard Hayes in his book on the Old Testament in Paul, where he tries to develop some criteria for distinguishing quotation, or sometimes called citation, allusion, and echo. Those three categories are not necessarily absolutely distinguishable. You can develop your criteria, and then you might quibble a bit whether you've got this one or another one, you see. And you can understand why. You could have a quotation that is actually verbatim from the LXX, let us say. Or you can see is a very literal translation of the MT over against the LXX. Yes, that happens too sometimes. Or is occasionally a very fine reflection of what one of the Targumim say. That also happens every once in a while. You see? Yeah, you can see where it's coming from. But sometimes you get a quotation that is really quite loose, no matter what it's dependent upon. And some authors do more of that than others. John's gospel is notoriously loose. You see, it is very, very loose in its handling of text. Well, the looser you get, And the shorter the quotation, the more you start wondering if you're better off thinking not so much of a quotation as an allusion. You can understand why the borders between these things become a bit porous with time. Still, it's worth thinking about these sorts of distinctions somewhere along the line. You pick up, on the other hand, an echo when, for example, a person's name is dropped into the narrative. And the question becomes whether you're supposed to bring with that Old Testament name the whole pattern of something from that person's life or not. There is an echo of something there, but how much of that do you presuppose as you start reading the New Testament text which actually drops in his name? There is an echo of the Old Testament. How much of it is brought through, do you see? And that becomes a more difficult question to decide as well. All right, now there are other important issues, but before we start trying to focus in on some of them, let me pause now for some questions before we proceed. You had a question.
In John's Gospel, Jesus said, "You are God." Yeah. And he's using the Greek term theos, theos.
Well, at this point, I will answer that, but at this point, instead of throwing this open to every hard case that you can think of, I want to deal with some of the principles that are at stake, and then I'll try to open it up to questions about the hard cases, because otherwise this will go on into focusing on this little text and this little text and this little text, and it won't be dealing with any of the principles. But let me say something about that one. Many, many people have argued, in my judgment rightly, that Jesus is using what is often called an ad hominem argument there. In other words, his opponents are objecting to the use of theos as an appropriate title, and he's saying, "Oh, give me a break, back off a wee bit. I mean, the Old Testament text itself can use that term in this sort of usage. Cut me some slack." And it may not be much more than that, because there are certainly some places where Jesus is quite prepared to use ad hominem arguments. So sometimes we come to usages of texts that are we get into difficulty because, I will overstate this and then back off and qualify it immediately, because we're too serious. you see, we're trying to milk it for too much theology too fast, when in fact that's not quite what's going on. I think it is merely an ad hominem argument, and I've argued that at some length in my John commentary, but many have argued that. C.K. Barrett argues that. Even Brown argues that, and his approach is much looser than mine, and so on, you see. I don't think that's a really tough one, to be honest. Yes?
What about places where it seems that the New Testament writer, like Paul, takes one quote from one place, another from another,
yes,
puts them together,
yes,
and then
yes,
another question, which is the other extreme, what about places where you don't find the quote from the quote?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, they're two quite different things. The first one, where you put text together, in terms of appropriation technique, that's a pretty common rabbinic habit. That is, you say, with a hook word or something like that, you find another text that seems to be related because of the hook word, and so the two texts must be related in some sense. So at the level of appropriation technique, there's nothing surprising. So the question becomes, therefore, at the substantial level, what is Paul or anybody else? Mark does this. Matthew does this. It's a pretty common phenomenon in the New Testament when you start looking for it. What is being done by this? How is this being handled? You see, in the very famous text at Jesus' baptism, "This is my son," so on. It's pretty clear that there's allusion both to a psalm and to Isaiah 42, one of the servant songs. And I think that there is, in fact, theological insistence in this bifurcation of texts, which means that Jesus is to be interpreted both ways. So we do that sometimes too, do we not? Where we might, in full flow, in a sermon, quote some biblical text and say, do you not recall that the Apostle Paul says, then you give a quotation, and then throw in something else from some other text because it's associated with it? And we're not actually saying that Paul says the other bit, but we've quoted a genuine bit from Paul and then pulled in some further biblical quotation, you see? I don't think that most of those are hard to understand what is going on. The challenge is trying to figure out exactly what theological capital to make of it. There are just a few passages where you have an actual introductory formulae and you're not sure what text is being quoted. And they have to be handled case by case. Let me mention two to show how they might be handled differently. Because in both of them, in fact, I've treated at some length in some commentary or other. And I'm not saying that you need to follow my particular approach either. I'm just saying that I've tried to wrestle with those things. One is found in John 7, 37 to 39. There the problem is not that there's no Old Testament possible source. There the problem is that because John is so often loose in his use of the Old Testament, there are connections between John's quotation and several Old Testament passages, and there's a dispute about which one is meant. You see? And it slightly changes how you understand what John is doing in 7:37 to 39, depending on which text you think he's quoting. Now, in fact, I had when I was teaching one of my doctoral seminars a few years ago, I had an Old Testament scholar in there from the department who was also listening in, and we started doing some work together. And eventually, we came to the conclusion that there was another Old Testament background that is not commonly cited in the literature. I think it's Nehemiah 9. So, in fact, I have a sort of 10-page excursus on that in my John commentary, because I think actually there are thematic structures that are connecting that passage self-consciously that connect Holy Spirit, tabernacles, and a whole lot of other things to the Nehemiah 9 passage. Now, the point is, in that case, the problem is not that there is no Old Testament connection. It's trying to figure out which is the right one and try to be sober. And there you have to give reasons. Again, it's warrant. We might be less sure in some cases about what's going on. But in principle, that's not more difficult than other cases where we're not quite sure what's going on as well. The more challenging one is one like the Nazareth one. In Matthew chapter 2, the most common answer given to that is that there is a pun going on with netzer in Hebrew for branch. So it's tied to the branch passage in the Old Testament. That's the most common explanation. And that's possible. It's possible. It's not what I think is right. I think there's something else going on. There is plenty of first century literature, Josephus and elsewhere, that shows how much Galilee was despised by first century Palestinian Jews in the south. And in Galilee, Nazareth is very regularly, especially despised. That's common in the literature. People know that. The text itself actually breaks the regular formulaic introduction that Matthew uses in the four other quotations in Matthew 2. There are four quotations that precede it. And look, for example, 2:17, then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. Or a little further on, a little further back in verse 15, and so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet. And then there's a specific quotation. Or back in chapter 2, verse 5, in Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But when you get to the last one, 2:23, so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, plural. In every other case, there's a reference to a particular prophet and then a quotation that is pretty unambiguous. Here there is a general reference to the prophets. And at a guess, I'm only guessing, I won't nail this down, nothing deep hangs on it. I think that this is part of Matthew's understanding, and it's a common New Testament understanding, that the Old Testament texts picture the coming Messiah as being despised. So he's betrayed in the Psalms. He's the despised servant in Isaiah 53. He's rejected in Zechariah, and on and on and on. And all of these texts are picked up in the Old Testament and understood to be part of the Old Testament picture of a despised Messiah, not a kingly Messiah. So, what has been going on in this passage? Well, he's been born in Bethlehem, in Judea. He's the Davidic son. But he is going to be known not as Jesus the Bethlehemite. He's going to be known as Jesus the Nazarene. In which case, you see, this may simply be saying, look, already there was ample Old Testament warrant for saying that he would be the despised one. And this becomes a paraphrastic way of saying no more than that. So was fulfilled, because he went back up into Galilee. What was said in the prophets? He would be called a Nazarene. So it's a bit like every country, you see, has places like that, don't they? I mean, in Australia, if you're from Queensland, then you're slow and thick. In America, if you're born in the Ozarks, then you're slow and thick. Do you see? And I suspect in most of your countries, I mean, in Poland, tell me, is there some place where if you come from a certain part of the country, you really are a bit stupid? Yeah? You know, it's not fair, of course, but I mean, most countries have ways of talking about that. You see, well, in the first century, if you're from Galilee, I mean, you find that elsewhere, don't you? Galilee of the Gentiles, you see? And likewise, you find, judge for yourself, does any prophet come out of Galilee? That's also John's Gospel. Do you see? Does any prophet come out of Galilee? Ah, yes, 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 he shall be called a Nazarene. That's what the prophets, plural, say. Now, don't forget, too, that in the first century, there was no orthography to mark direct quotations. A hati could introduce them, but a hati could introduce a paraphrase or a theme, too. There was no quotation mark orthography. So this may be saying, oh, look, he's going back up to Galilee and living in Nazareth, despite the fact that we've just said that he came from the tribe of David. That's what the genealogy says, chapter 1. He was born in Bethlehem, according to the fulfillment of prophecy from Micah chapter 5, verse 2. Nevertheless, the prophets also say that he would be despised, and so he was called a Nazarene. See, it could be saying no more than that. Now, I'm not going to... I'm not prepared to die for that interpretation, but it seems to me that it's entirely within the range of coherence and so forth. Okay? Now, I'm not going to take any more individual texts now, just because I want to get into the larger theme. So if you're dealing with the questions of the larger themes and what I've said out so far, then I'll take a couple of questions.
I don't know if you will speak about tomorrow, but I would be interested if you could be more specific about your criticism about the Rabbi Charles and the project.
I probably will end up saying a little bit more about it in connection with mystery and fulfillment, but give me a little room, and then you can ask at the end if we may. Yes.
We talked about how there can be two meanings that an author means to say. Both of these meanings can be inspired. But what if the author means one thing, and then later on it is said that it means something else? And
right.
If the author didn't originally intend this meaning, can the other meaning be inspired?
Yes. Did you understand the question? Yeah. That is the approach taken. I skipped over this entirely, but that's the sort of approach taken by those who follow the Hirsch camp on sense and significance. So there's an unpacking of further significance. In fact, in some cases, the Frege camp, where you have sense and referent, is taken along those lines too. So that what is argued is there's a fulfillment of something at the level of sense, but not at the level of referent. So people make all kinds of judgments along those lines. And then in the Catholic tradition, what you appeal to is sensus plenior, you see? And then in the typology, you're saying, well, it belongs to the same sort of typological structure. And in every case, the question that has to be raised to justify any of those is, what is the textual warrant for this sort of reasoning? And what we'll have to look at is some hard cases in a few minutes. I want to fill in some.
Like the Matthew Hosea.
Yeah. Well, that one I spent about 10 pages on the commentary. I'm not going to deal with that one in this one. It's just too long and complicated. I think there are some things that can be said. But I'll... I will allude to that one briefly if we get to it when I start talking about typology and sonship and so on. It's a complicated one, and I'm not sure I've got it right. But I have published on that one, so you can do some more reading for yourself. There's a vast literature on it.
But as evangelicals, do we still hold to the inspired meaning of the text is what the author meant to say?
What you're appealing to is what Walter Kaiser calls single intent theory. I think single intent theory works in a lot of places. I doubt that it works well in typology. And there's a reason for that. We'll come to that tomorrow. So give me some space and I'll come back to that one. Okay? So I will come back to that one. All right. Now that we've solved all the problems, just making notes to make sure that I put in some of these things now that I've promised that I would put in so that I don't prove to be a liar. If I talk fast enough, I'll be able to give you a sensus plenior. Let me come, if you're following the outline, I've given you a survey of some of the fundamental issues. I want to come now to the first set of tough cases that I've called the fulfillment theme, the fulfillment of law. And we'll start with Matthew's Gospel. Now, I introduced this theme yesterday, briefly, in the workshop. May I ask how many of you were at the workshop yesterday afternoon? Just three or four. So I've got to back up a bit and fill in a bit of what I gave in the workshop, but I want to fill it in much more fully this time. Matthew 5:17. Matthew 5:17 to 20 is one of the most disputed paragraphs in Matthew's Gospel, but it's also very interesting for this whole matter. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Now, the standard interpretation of this passage amongst those who believe most strongly in the Thomistic and Calvinistic tripartite division of law is this. What Jesus has in mind, they say, is moral law. Because there is some sense, surely, in which you would want to argue that Jesus does come to abolish various kinds of ceremonial law. Thus we read in Matthew chapter 15, the same book. This Jesus said, making all foods clean. Doesn't that abolish the law? Do you see? So what he is really referring to here, it is argued, is moral law. And then if you ask, what does Jesus mean by the two principal verbs here, I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill, you've got some sort of contrast going on. And the opposite of abolish is surely something like maintain or even deepen. I haven't come to abolish them. I've come to deepen them or intensify them. And further, it is argued, when you read the following verses, 21 to the end of the chapter, in the six antitheses that follow, in every case, you're dealing with matters in what would traditionally be called the moral realm. So, it is argued, what Jesus is saying is here, I have not come to abolish the moral law of God. I haven't come to abolish it. I've come to deepen it, intensify it, maintain it, fulfill it in that sense. Do you see? So you find that not only in learned conservative commentaries, you find it also in popular expositions. Read, for example, John Stott's Christian Counterculture, which is his exposition of the Sermon on the Mount. In many ways, it is a very good and useful and interesting book. But that really is his argument in a nutshell here. At the end of the day, I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced, first of all, for two reasons. First, that presupposes that Jesus and or Matthew has already bought into the tripartite division of law. Which, in fact, you cannot find unambiguously until Thomas. 13th century. Makes you a bit nervous. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but it does make you nervous. Now, it is true to say that Jesus can distinguish kinds of law or importance of law, but he uses categories that are Jewish. For example, in Matthew 23:23, in connection with the matter of tithing, he says, "You tithe the garden herbs, mint and cumin and anise." And then he says, "You have ignored the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and so forth." So he's got to distinguish between the light and the heavy. That's a common rabbinic way. That is, which one is more important? That's likewise seen, you see, in the discussion in Mark 12 in parallels. Master, which is the most important commandment in the law? That is, which is the heaviest one? That's what the rabbis would have said. Which is the heaviest commandment? That was a rabbinic discussion going on. So there are distinctions being made, all right, between what is more and less heavy. But nevertheless, as a category, you cannot find the tripartite distinction, moral, civil, ceremonial, as a given, which is already a presupposed set of categories on the table, which enables you then to make the distinctions between continuity and discontinuity that this sort of approach demands. And if you try to use merely a light and heavy distinction here, you get into very big trouble with the next verse. "I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of the pen, shall in any way disappear from the law until everything is accomplished." Well, that doesn't sound like just the heavier bits. Or to use the Thomistic distinction, it doesn't sound like just the moral bits. It's pretty comprehensive, isn't it? On the face of it. Not the jot or the tittle. Almost certainly the jot. Where did I drop this? Oh, it's a nice magnet, yeah. The jot is probably merely a transliteration, of course, for the Hebrew yod, the smallest letter in the consonantal system. And the tittle, so-called, the least stroke of a pen, there are three pairs of letters, of course, in Hebrew, where there's only one small distinction in the forming of it. So that, for example, you have a resh, but then you also have daleth, and the only distinction is that. You see, and likewise, you have beit, and you also have kof, and the only distinction is that, and so forth. So the least stroke of the pen is almost certainly that sort of thing. So this is a very powerful way, a kind of visual way of saying nothing will be abolished from the law, not the least stroke of a pen, until all is accomplished and so forth, you see? So when you use language that strong, it's not very likely that what Jesus is really referring to is only the heavier stuff or only the moral stuff. You can make that work, you see, only by already prior adopting the tripartite distinction and assuming that it's already in place. But on the face of it, that strikes me as a terribly anachronistic reading. I think it is much better to begin by looking at Matthew's usages of the verbs themselves. Plerao, to fulfill, is a pretty complex verb. In the New Testament, it can be used in a variety of ways. In James, it is used in one context where it almost certainly means to perform something or the like. But most commonly in the New Testament, it is used in a kind of fulfillment pattern, a prophecy fulfillment one, a prediction fulfillment pattern. That's the most common usage, all right. And Matthew uses it, I've forgotten the exact number, 23 times, something like that. It's in the 20s in any case, pretty commonly. And I would be prepared to argue at considerable length that every single instance of Matthew's use of plerao has some kind of prophecy fulfillment assumption. In other words, there's some kind of prediction, and now the prediction is fulfilled. You're not talking about merely intensifying or keeping or maintaining. No, 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 no. You're talking about something else. That means that the argument, the antithesis in verse 17, does not mean, I have not come to abolish but to keep. Or, I have not come to abolish but to intensify. That's not what it's saying. It's saying instead, don't think for a moment that I've come here to smash the law, to abolish it. Don't think that I've come to abolish. That's not why I've come at all. I haven't come to abolish. I've come to be that to which it points. I've come to fulfill it eschatologically. I've come to bring it to the accomplishment that it was aiming for. You see, it is a salvation historical category. It is a prophetic fulfillment category. Now, there is a sense in which you and I are already prepared to think of law that way, are we not? We're more used to thinking of verbal predictions that way. And there are some verbal predictions in the Old Testament that are specific and literal, and then that are fulfilled in the New. There is one already in Matthew 2. The Magi come and say, where is the Redeemer to be born? Micah 5:2 is quoted. He must come from Bethlehem of Judea. Do you see? That is a specific verbal prediction from an 8th century prophet. And it's picked up then by Matthew's gospel, reporting the words of the Jews who were trying to explain things to Herod. And then the fulfillment is in an event. There is a prediction, and then there is a fulfillment. We're very familiar with that. But there is a sense in which, if we're Christians at all, precisely because we lean on some kind of typology, the warrant for it I'll come back to later, precisely because we do lean on certain kind of typology, we are prepared to say that there are elements in the law which are predictive, not by verbal prediction, but by institutional typology. We're doing that all the time with respect to temple language and priest language and so on. We'll come to Hebrews tomorrow, and where we argue very strongly, Hebrews gives its reasons for it, its warrant for it, for saying, look, the priesthood in the Old Testament was not only a structure within the Mosaic covenant, it was also in some sense a predictive thing that announced a greater priest. The temple, we saw briefly in John's gospel, the temple, the tabernacle, is not only something given in the Mosaic covenant, but on the other hand, Jesus is insists, according to John 2, that he is himself the ultimate temple, the ultimate meeting place between God and human beings. And the similar things are done for the Passover in Paul in 1 Corinthians 6. Christ, our Passover, was slain for us, and so forth. And so we do this sort of thing with respect to the mercy seat. The mercy seat, the hilasterion. Well, the hilasterion shows up, you see, in Romans chapter 3. So there are all kinds of institutional and structural things in the law, mostly bound up with cult, with worship, with the so-called ceremonial aspects of the law, where, in fact, we are already, as Christians, as we read the New Testament, unconsciously saying that they have a prophetic function in the whole stream of redemptive history. They are not only institutional structures in the law covenant, they have a certain kind of prophetic function, a predictive function, within the whole stream of redemptive history. Now, the warrant for that will come to tomorrow. But give me some slack again and say, yeah, maybe the New Testament is full of those, isn't it? I mean, they're hard to avoid. What the warrant is, we'll come to, but they're all over the place. And in that sense, we're already comfortable with the notion of the law having a predictive element. But when it comes to what we nowadays call moral law, then we're less comfortable with the law having a predictive element. The moral law merely prescribes. The priestly law predicts, or it prescribes for that covenant, but now today, it predicts what's going on today, we say. But I think that Jesus' point is, in certain profound ways, the entire law, however much it is legislative, however much it makes its demands, however it functions within the Mosaic covenant, the entire law has a predictive prophetic function, including what we more traditionally call moral law. I I think that's Jesus' argument here. Now, I want to tease that out tomorrow. It's already lunchtime. But I'll try teasing that out tomorrow with respect to the antitheses here and what the argument is and how that ties into Romans 3 that we've looked at and other passages as well. Okay? And so we'll play with that one a bit more before we're done and move on to other topics. Okay? See you tomorrow.